Well, thank you, Dr. Dunbar. It's just too bad to spoil a beautiful evening with all this good food and everything with the lecture at the end. That's the price you pay in order to get here. But it is a privilege to be here in connection with Biblical Seminary. I value very much the work of Biblical Seminary, the faculty and the students too. And also the work, the approach of Biblical Seminary on the subject of evolution. He spoke about having questions and answers. At least we'll have the questions. And as far as the answers are concerned, if we don't have time, well, you ask Dr. Newman over there. Dr. Newman has the answers. So I am glad to talk on the subject for two reasons. First of all, it is a desperately important subject. I do think that there's hardly anything that has done more to turn the modern mind against the Bible than the subject of evolution. I say that in the last 100 years, we have seen the devil's pincers movement against the Christian faith. And one of those pincers has been evolution in the university, and the other has been the higher criticism in the seminary. And those two things together have robbed multitudes of people of their faith. Faith in the Bible, and through that, faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. So we live in a time when you ask the ordinary person who is in the media or the university or someplace like that, why, of course they don't believe the Bible. Evolution has changed all that. Of course they don't believe in God. We believe in chance did everything. And they try to have some kind of values. They're worrying about value education in the high schools. But the real problem is what values will they give when they give values. So evolution is a very, very significant thing. The other thing of great interest is the change in the picture that is quite remarkable. I used to argue evolution when I was a kid. My brother and I lived up here near New Hope, Pennsylvania, in a little country town, not even on the map now. But there was a doctor's son across the road, and he was in favor of evolution. We were against it. So he didn't know much about it, and we didn't know much of the opposite, but we knew we were against it. But my interest in evolution goes back to childhood. And some of the old arguments have been repeated again and again and again. But you know, the things that evolutionists have propounded and that they have confidently asserted for at least 75 years are now being denied by the leading evolutionists. And that's an astonishing thing, and it's a very gratifying thing. They have begun to admit the things that we have alleged against the theory. They still hold to the theory. They say it's not a theory. Evolution is a fact. Well, it's not a fact like other facts. But at least evolution is under attack. And it has changed so much, it's a question of whether it ought to be called evolution. The new ideas have been given by particularly a man named Jay Gould at Harvard, and a friend of his, I guess, Niles Eldridge at the American Museum of Natural History, and they have argued for a new type of evolution. Actually, that was propounded some years earlier by a man named Richard Goldschmidt in California. He was a specialist in the cell. And Richard Goldschmidt wrote an extensive work some years ago. It came to my attention while Faith Seminary was still down in Wilmington. It would be in the 40s. And the late Dr. William Chisholm was our missionary in Korea, a physician, a very fine man, capable, member of the American College of Physicians and Surgeons. Dr. Chisholm read one of the books of Goldschmidt, drew it to my attention, told me that I ought to write a review of this book for the Sunday School Times. Well, I was very much interested in the book, but I told him that, after all, he should write the book as a review for the Sunday School Times. We did it together. And Goldschmidt, propounded a new type of evolution, which all the evolutionists objected to. Oh, Goldschmidt was terrible. He was castigated by all of the scientific community. The new views of Gould and Eldridge are remarkably close to Goldschmidt, and they admit it. So I say there are very new things that are going on in evolution. Another book has come to my attention, one just not too long ago. I forget what the actual date is. Maybe I should look it up and see. Copyright in 1980, published in the United States in 1986. This is a book written by a man in Australia, Michael Denton. It's called Evolution, A Theory in Crisis. And the interesting thing to me is that he goes one step beyond Eldridge and Gould in a very interesting and important way. So I say there are new winds blowing, and it's hard to keep up with the field that moves so fast. And so everything that I say tonight, well, you know that 10 years from now, it'll be something quite different than what you believe. So. So you take notes very carefully, and then maybe throw them away. Also, I should mention two other books that I imagine most of you are familiar with. This book by Duane Gish, used to be called Evolution, The Fossils Say No. It is, the revised edition is called Evolution, The Challenge of the Fossil Record. And Gish is a very competent man, and he has, in the back of the revised edition, he has some very helpful descriptions about the new theories and finds concerning human remains in the dry areas, Tanganyika and Kenya, and the Ethiopia of Africa. Another book that is particularly valuable on the subject of the origin of life is a book also rather well known to you probably, Gary Parker, Creation, The Facts of Life. Now, these two books are products of the Creation Research Society out in California. The Creation Research Society has a little history, too. Before it was started, there was a society that was founded. I forget the date of it exactly, but it was called the American Scientific Affiliation. About 30 years ago, there had been founded a society of theologians, the Evangelical Theological Society, and about that same time, there was this American Association of Christian Scientists, American Scientific Affiliation. Well, that was a very fine thing. It was founded primarily to oppose evolution. But little by little, and inch by inch, the thing changed, and they changed their creed twice against the opposition, voiced extensively by Alan McRae and me too. We were both members of that society. And eventually, they really almost adopted a theistic evolution position, at least so it seemed to us. And so we left it, and others did too, and they founded the Creation Research Society. Well, that Creation Research Society, I was a member for a little while, and then after a little while, somebody wrote to me and said, how can I be a member of that society, because I didn't believe in the 24-hour day theory of Genesis 1. So I said, well, I didn't know that that was in the works. Actually, I guess it was passed at a meeting that I didn't attend. And so I bowed out and told them that I was very sorry, but I wanted to keep in touch with them and so on. And they have done a great deal of good, their society. Personally, I feel, and I think Dr. Newman and the other men here at Biblical also feel, that the Creation Research Society, although it has done a great deal of good, and has brought the matter of evolution to the attention of many people, and has published some very valuable books like this, I do feel that they have also given us some problems, because they have been so insistent on the 24-hour day. The question is the interpretation, of course, of Genesis 1. And you tell them that the word yom does not always mean 24 hours, and they say, yes, but if it has got a number with it, well, it means 24 hours. Well, of course, all the hundreds of times that yom is used, it doesn't very often have a number with it. And so they can make that statement, but actually it's not too meaningful a statement. But they're very insistent that the world was started not too long ago. They're willing to admit gaps in the genealogies of Genesis 5 and Genesis 11. So they do not put the date of the creation of Adam and Eve at 4004, as Usher did. Usher, people poke a lot of fun at Usher, you know, but actually Usher and Lightfoot with him were not giving something new. They were giving the interpretation of the Bible as given by the medieval rabbis. Somehow they don't make fun of the medieval rabbis. They just make fun of Usher and Lightfoot. But at least the Creation Research Society people are willing to put the creation of Adam and Eve a little bit earlier. Not too much earlier, maybe 20, 30,000 B.C. instead of 4,000. And then they insist that the world and the stars and everything else was created within a literal week before that. Well, that's a position very difficult to maintain. It may well be true that the world is not as old as scientists say it is. The radioactive measurements do have some problems. And so I'm not sure that the world was started 20 billion, the universe started 20 billion years ago. I think Mark Twain had a remark that it was, what he would say, 10 billion years ago. He says, come next tater digging time. We don't have to be too precise, perhaps, on the date, actually, of the creation of the universe and of the world. But that was started just 20, 30,000 years ago. It doesn't seem very logical when you look at the everlasting hills and things the Bible says about the world. However, this is the claim. Now, if the anti-evolution view is tied to a recent Earth, then we're at somewhat of a disadvantage. Now, we're at a disadvantage always if we disbelieve the Bible, or we're also at a disadvantage if we go beyond the Bible. And I do feel that we ought to be very careful and not to insist on the recent Earth. If the Earth is recent, I don't care. I mean, God could have made it yesterday, I guess, and given us all the impression of age. But actually, yeah, why not? But to insist on this, if the Bible doesn't insist on it, I think is very unfortunate. There is one argument against the recent Earth that I feel is of some consequence, and that is the treatment of the seventh day. The claim is that the 6 days must be six literal days of 24 hours. But it seems to me that the seventh day, the day of God's rest from creation, according to what I read in Hebrews, is going on still. God's day of rest is not the same as not a 24-hour day of rest. Now, of course, God is always active, but in his rest from creation, according to the Psalm, apparently, and according to Hebrews, it seems, that we enter into that rest, and there remaineth that rest for the people of God. If God's day of rest is a long day, and the short 24-hour human Sabbath is symbolic of God's long day, well, then presumably also the 24-hour Monday of the work week could well be equal to a long day of God's work week. And to insist that God's day must be the same as the human day is opposed, I think, to the biblical teaching. So I feel that that it is very unfortunate to have to insist on a recent Earth, and I do not do so. Then the question comes up, did God create these things, or did they just happen? And that, of course, is the question of evolution. Well, so let me go more directly to that particular subject. And I'll say something tomorrow about the relationship between Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 that I hope will be helpful, but that doesn't bear on the main problem that is before us of evolutionary theory. Now, Darwin, as you know, operated in 1859 with publication of his book. He operated at a time when there was a lot about science that people didn't know. Darwin thought knew a good bit about science. He thought that you could extrapolate from the observed changes in organisms to major changes in organisms. He was quite a fancier of pigeons and the breeding of pigeons. And you know, you breed pigeons, you get all different kinds. Well, perhaps you're more familiar with the breeding of dogs, and you think of all the different kinds of dogs that you can get. a little tiny dog that fit in a teacup, and then there's a great big St. Bernard dog that eats you out of house and home. And so there are all kinds of dogs, and some dogs have long tails, some dogs short tails. You can breed them for white hair, for black hair, whatever. And the same way, farmers breed cows. I had a cousin in Pennsylvania, not far away. He bred cows to give lots of cream. The company gave a premium for lots of cream. And so he, after some years, got his herd giving milk with lots of cream. Just at that time, the company changed its policy and no longer gave a bonus for cream. So you can breed cows for cream. But you know, there comes a limit. You can't breed cows to give 50% cream. You can give 4%, 5%, maybe 7%. I don't know what the limit is. But there is a limit. And this is the thing that Darwin did not see. Darwin felt that just as you could breed the tail of a dog for length, well, you could breed it longer and longer. And if you breed a dog to be one type, first thing you know, you could turn into a wolf, or you could turn into a fox, you could turn into anything he wants. Give him time enough, he could turn into anything. And this is the idea, that there is a pressure, you might say, to change in all kinds of ways. Then Darwin said that this pressure was balanced by natural selection and the struggle of the fittest, and that struggle of the fittest meant that those who changed and fitted something new became a new species. And so he extrapolated from the little changes that we see around us to a major change. Now, the little changes that we see around us, we don't doubt them. We speak of different races, of breeds, of dogs, of people, or whatnot. Probably we should admit that there are broader possibilities, what the term used is microevolution, that there are relationships between such things as wolves and dogs. I learned something the other day, that the difference between a wolf and a dog, a wolf doesn't bark. A dog can howl, and a wolf can howl, but apparently a wolf doesn't bark. Now, I've not been around wolves long enough to test that out. But that's the claim. On the other hand, they're very, very similar, you know. And lions and tigers are very similar. I've heard it said that if you find a skeleton in the woods, you know it's a tiger. If you find that same skeleton out in the plains, you know it's a lion. No difference in the skeletons. There are differences in the creatures, but not too great differences. And I understand that they have been bred. I'm not too sure about the details of that. But the definition of a species is not too clear. In general, we say that species are creatures that will not interbreed with others. That's the definition of species. But sometimes that definition is not quite satisfactory. We all know that there are Baltimore Orioles, beautiful birds, make their nests in a swinging bag in the trees. There were in the plains of the western state, Nebraska and all, there were plains orioles that were apparently related, but built their nests in different ways, different plumage. There were no trees out there to speak of. Well, after settlement took place and people moved in and put trees in their front lawns and all, it turned out finally the Baltimore Orioles moved out west too, and after they'd moved out west, it seems that they interbred freely. And what had been called two species actually was only one species. And so the definition of species is not too clear. I don't know that we need to specify exactly what it is. The Bible does not. The Bible says things are to reproduce after their kind and doesn't give any details. There is a possibility of what is called micromutation. I think we don't need to fight that battle. However, the question still remains, what about getting from one major type of life to another major type of life? Well, as I said, Darwin had the idea that you could go from one major type of life. Move over here a little bit. So you could go from one major type of life by small increments, and there would be all different kinds of variation. These different kinds of variations, some of them would be beneficial, And if they were beneficial, there would be more of these and less of these. And then they, of course, would have all kinds of variation too. And they would, again, the forms that would be most beneficial, that they would reproduce and continue. And the fittest would survive. And you would finally, after several links in between here, you would get another type of life. So from one to two, you would go by small gradation, and that was his theory. Now, of course, it's a question of fact, and he did not know the work of Mendel, which had been done by his time, and I understand that the work of Mendel had been reported to England, but the ideas of Darwin were much more popular, and so the work of Gregor Mendel was not used by Darwin at all. Mendel argued that there were limits to the variation. The limits were that if whatever the parents had, the genes, or he didn't know what genes were, but the characteristics that the parents had would reappear in the children and would reappear in certain ways. He had famous experiments with peas, and he said that you would have this one, you would cross white peas and red peas, you have so many pink peas, so many white peas, so many red peas, and you could mathematically predict what it would be. So the picture here of that fit the Mendelian Mendelian genetics was that you would have variations, but these variations would be within the gene pools, we would say, of the parents. And instead of going on from one to another, it would come back. There would be limits to this variation. And those limits would not be transgressed. And so the Mendelian ideas were very much opposed to the Darwinian ideas. There was a book written sometime in the early part of this century on that subject that argued that that this would be the end of the Darwinian view. And it would have been the end of the Darwinian view, except for one thing. Another theory was hatched, not Darwinian. De Vries is a man, I think, that is given the main credit for it. He argued that it was that evolution did not take place because of these little increments that are inherited from one generation to another. Granted that they would have limits to them. But he said that there were mutations that occurred, and these mutations were the mainspring of evolution. Now, by mutations, you know what we mean. We call them sports sometimes. I saw one time at a fair, saw a six-legged cow. She had two legs dangling from her neck. Weren't very much use, but there they were. These mutations occur in people. There's an article in news recently about sickle cell anemia, which is very common in Africa and is found particularly among blacks in this country. Without treatment and so on, a person dies early, around their 20s, I think. Sickle cell anemia. There are others, of course, a cleft palate and hair lip and things like that that we see that are unfortunate. And there are mutations. The idea was that once in a while, there would be a beneficial mutation. Now, see, that's already theoretical. That there are mutations is clear. Most of them, you operate on them and take care of them. A friend who had five fingers, six digits, and an extra little finger. He showed me the scar where it had been taken off. I don't know what the size and all of it was. I suppose it was taken off when he was a baby. Six digits on the hand. Well, it's a mutation. According to this view, six digits on the hand might be a good mutation. Eventually, since people with more fingers could do more things, eventually all of us would have six fingers on the hand. It'd be a great thing. I heard recently an argument against evolution, a real positive argument against evolution. They said if evolution was true and the fittest would survive, why, all mothers would have four hands. Be very useful. But according to this view, and you'll see it's very similar, there would be a mutation that would be beneficial. Now, we haven't seen one, but we hope that there would be, given time enough. the beneficial mutation. And that beneficial mutation would be maintained, and it was real beneficial, it would prosper. And eventually, after a second blue moon, you'd have another mutation, and you would have something like this. Well, you see, the theory is just the same as the other one, only you have mutations instead of the instruments by breeding. So you would get from one to the other by an addition of small mutations. An addition of small mutations. And that would fit Darwin's ideas. Darwin had the idea, expressed it in Latin, that nature avoids sudden leaps. Naturo, natura, saltem, non facit, I think it was, he said. Nature avoids jumps. Now, of course, how did Darwin know that nature avoided jumps? He didn't say that. But at least that was his idea. So the idea was that by gradual increase and addition of small mutations, that was the mechanism of evolution. This is the view that carried the day from around 1905, when this was idea came out by DeVries, I think, to the around 1970s. This was evolution. Now, of course, it's a question of fact. It's very nice to draw a picture like this on the board, but just as it was with Darwin, the question is, does it happen that way? And the claim was that it did happen that way, under all kinds of arguments. Well, one thing was done to test this evolutionary method, beginning in Columbia University and then in other universities. Since 1917, they've been studying these little fruit flies. Drosophila melanogaster, it's called. Drosophila is a good name. It means Greek for lover of garbage. And that's the description as well as the name. They don't live very long. You can get lots of generations in a short time before you finish your graduate study. And I sometimes scratch my head when I think how many fruit flies have been raised in this country since 1917. And they have tried to make them mutate. There are some mutations that come automatically, but the mutations come more if you would give them X-rays, or if you give them radiation, or if you give them, I'm not sure that changes of humidity and pressure and so on cause mutation, but they tried everything they could get to make these fruit flies mutate. And sure enough, they would mutate. You would get a fruit fly with banded eyes. You'd get a fruit fly with no wings. That would not be particularly helpful. They wouldn't survive. They would not be fit, you know. But you would get other mutations, sometimes double wings, and so on. Goldschmidt, who wrote after a good bit of this experimentation had gone on, Goldschmidt insisted that after all the study of all the fruit flies, there was no species, no new species formed that would be equal to a new species in nature. There are different forms, you could classify them, but were they really different species? Well, you might call them, it might say that it is micromutation. Again, it depends on your definition of the species. But after the whole thing is done, what they have is fruit flies. And so you have to, according to that study, you have to redraw the thing and say, and some of these mutations, by the way, come back again and again. You know, some have more body hair, some have less body hair. I believe there was a limit of 18 body hairs. Why the limit was 18, nobody knew. But it comes back to the picture we had before. It seems as if mutation takes place within a particular circle. And so this raises a question about the validity of the evolutionary theory here. How do you get, this is the big question, how do you get from one to two? And according to this business of mutations, you couldn't get that way as far as they could discover in the laboratory. Of course, there are other problems with it. One problem is that these mutations, by the way, happen, you know, by pure accident. You can't force a mutation. You can't pull the dog's tail and have the next generation be longer-tailed. You can cut the tail off and have that generation have a short tail, but you can't do it the other way around. These are accidental mutations. But you know, accidental mutations, if they're going to be valuable, sometimes they have to be either extreme mutations or else they have to have parallel mutations. Just quickly, the example I give for that is a giraffe's neck. The theory of Darwin was that the giraffe would stretch and stretch, and there would be a famine, a dry period, and the giraffe that would be able to reach the higher branches and get more of the upper leaves would be the ones that would survive. And the others would not survive. And after many generations like this, well, you would have a giraffe with a long neck. A few problems with that, of course. That drought would have had to last a good long time. So long that you would expect that the ordinary deer and wildebeest and so on would not be around at all. Why the giraffe would have a long neck and nobody else would have a long neck, they did not explain. But now the new theory would be that the giraffe would develop this long neck and by mutations like this, accidental mutations. But you know, if you have these accidental mutations and you get a long neck, it's not enough to have a long neck. You have to have other things too. Suppose you get what I'm coming to is now is the bigger mutations, which is a more recent theory. But with the bigger mutations, you get a long neck and you imagine here a giraffe, and the giraffe now has a longer neck than all his cousins. And he comes to a water hole, and the water hole, of course, he looks around to see if any lions, tigers around, and none. And so he takes his neck, which is now 16 feet above the ground, and dips down to get some water. 16 feet. There to there. What happens? What happens to the blood pressure in an animal like that? You know that the atmospheric pressure of water is 32 feet. And that's half an atmosphere. And you take a giraffe brain and hit it with a half an atmosphere of blood flow, it'd be the last of that giraffe. Or if the other way around, if he raised his head up, he would stagger around for a long time before he was able to operate with a brain with no blood to it. It just so happens that the giraffe, of all animals, has at the base of its head a complicated sponge-like set of capillaries that the blood flows through, which acts like a check valve. And that's very handy. So he can dip his head all the way down, get the water, and it doesn't get a surge of blood to his head. He can raise his head all the way up, and blood doesn't drain away from his head the way, his brain the way it would with us. Now he's not happy to have those two mutations side by side. The surge valve without the heart, a strong heart and high neck, if those three would have to come together. Parallel mutations of an extreme nature like this, and all by accident, is really pretty much the belief. And this is, of course, only one example of such mutations. Random mutations would require mutations to be complete and to be effective. Of course, another one is the feathers of a bird. How do you get scales into feathers? Well, that's quite a mutation to get scales into feathers. Little by little and inch by inch, you get scales into feathers. What's the poor animal doing in the 3 million years or so in between? You say it's neither fish nor fowl. That's not much good. So there's a real question about the evolution by mutation. And it was argued for a long time, and although they couldn't prove it in a sense, they would always say, well, of course, we can't see it because it happens so slowly, but you can read it in the record of the rocks. Now, read it in the record of the rocks. That's exactly where Gish comes out. The record of the rocks does not teach that. And this is the thing that Christians have been saying for a century. And only recently have the scientists begun to admit it. But they have admitted it now. And as I say, these two men particularly, Eldridge and Eldridge of the American Museum of Natural History ought to know something about fossils, and Gould of Harvard. And Gould says that the lack of intermediate species in the fossil record has been one of the best-kept secrets of paleontology. Well, it's not been a secret as far as Christians are concerned, but they have insisted that evolution is proved by the rocks, and now the leading scientists are saying that it is not so, that there are no intermediate forms between. And Michael Denton, in this book, he makes an interesting observation. He says, not only have the opponents of evolution argued that there are no intermediate forms, but the people themselves admit there's no intermediate form. Darwin was very much distressed by the fact that you could not see intermediate forms between the major types of life. He said the reason we don't see them is because we don't have enough fossils. And in his day, perhaps that argument could be held because we didn't have enough fossils. But think of the multitudes of fossils that have come into our museums in the years since. And people have finally begun to admit that the record of evolution is that you have a new animal that appears and continues for many years and then dies off, and another animal appears and continues for a long time and then dies off. Now, of course, there are some animals that continue. Starfish and all continue from the very beginning. And there are some animals that have continued and the people thought they had died off, and they did not. Famous example of that is the fish called coelacanth, the coelacanth fish. Now, the coelacanth fish was a fish that had bones in its fins. And there were bones, there are fish like that in the fossil record. And it was thought that these fish with bones in their fins were the ancestors of the lizards and whatnot that came out, amphibians that came out from the water. And because they had bones in their fins where they could move, and as they moved, and that was very useful, some of them got stronger bones, and that was even more useful. And first thing you know, they had legs. And these were the ancestors of these creatures on the land. Now, the pictures are given both by Gish and also by Denton. There are some problems with it. First of all, this fish was called a living fossil because it had been thought to be extinct. Well, now it turns up to be side by side with these fish that are supposed to have been its descendants. But another thing that is of interest is that now we have not only the bones of this fish, but we have the body parts of this fish. And the body parts of this fish turn out to be just like any other fish. They do have bones in the fins. Seven bones in the fins. How they lost three and changed the other four is not explained. And people are beginning to see that it is not explainable. And so most gratifying thing is the declaration that is being made again and again today that the fossil record does not show this low gradation, whether by variation or whether by mutation or what, it does not show this slow gradation from one type to another. You have this kind of animal, you have this kind of animal or plant, this kind of animal or plant. It comes for a while, and then it dies out, and then others are formed. And so the picture of evolution fails from the biological angle, and now it is seen to fail also from the geological angle. And this is very impressive. And men like Gish have of course, argued that. They have quoted Jay Gould. Jay Gould hates it. They've quoted Eldridge, and he doesn't want them to quote him, but it's very quotable what he says. And these men are opposed to evolution as we have known it for all these years. They call it punctuated equilibrium. Explain that a little bit. What they say is that the evolution has happened all right. They believe in evolution. Only dumb bunnies don't believe in evolution. They're sure they know that evolution took place. It is a fact. But it took place in big jumps. this was the view of Goldschmidt, that they just spoke against Goldschmidt. These men didn't, but others did, when he was working 30-40 years ago. But these men are repeating what Goldschmidt said, that mutations occur rapidly, and you get what he called a hopeful monster. A mutation be a monster, but once in a while you get a hopeful monster, you see. Now, Gould has a little bit of a change on that. He says not that it happened all of a sudden that, for instance, turtle lays an egg and comes out a chicken. It isn't quite exactly like that. What he says is that you would have a group of animals. Suppose you say here's a bunch of, we'll call them chickens. Here's a bunch of chickens, and they live together happily in the west and the east side of the Appalachians. And then, of course, this takes many, many years. Little mutations come. Some you get white chickens, black chickens, barred rock chickens, and whatnot. You get all different kinds of chickens, but they're all chickens. However, through some mistake, accident, some chickens went over here. And all of a sudden, there was a big mountain range between them, and earthquake or whatnot, volcano or whatnot, and you had a small bunch of chickens over here. Now, these small chickens, this group of chickens here, had the pressure of the whole population to keep them chickens. But this small group over here, the accumulated mutations kind of blossomed, shall we say. And so you had very rapid rates of mutations over here. That's why I call it punctuated equilibrium. And so you have your evolution occurring this way. Well, now that's a very interesting theory. When I turn to Michael Denton's work, I thought that probably he was going to support the views of Gould and Eldridge and others. But he made a statement here that I thought was interesting. He says, saltational, this is page 355, saltational models of evolution can never be subject to any sort of empirical confirmation. Say that again. Now, saltation means big jumps. He says, big jump models of evolution can never be subject to any sort of empirical confirmation. To put that in striking language, perhaps. This explains why they do not find fossils of these intermediate forms, you see. Because it happens so fast that there's no time for the intermediate forms to multiply, and for it takes quite a few animals for one fossil to be by accident preserved, you see. And so this is why you don't find any transitional forms. There were transitional forms, but we don't find them because it all happens so fast, you see. On the other hand, if you try to make them with fruit flies, why, it goes too slow to observe. So you see, this is a beautiful theory. These forms all worked, of course, but they worked too slow to leave traces, and too fast to leave traces, and too slow for us to repeat. Isn't that beautiful? Well, of course, that's what he says. He says, saltational models of evolution can never be subject to any sort of empirical confirmation. What that means is, if you want to hold this view of Gould, why, that's fine, that's your privilege. It's nice to be able to have that much faith. But the evidence is not there. And that's a very interesting point. So, I'm glad to hear a voice raised against Gould. Denton himself begins by saying that we believe in evolution, but what he means by that is microevolution. And that microevolution we may allow. The examples he gives are familiar ones. One of them, I don't know if he gives this one, but this is one easily understood. There are rattlesnakes in Florida. I hope no Floridians here would take offense, but there are rattlesnakes in Florida, and these rattlesnakes will breed, I understand, with some in Georgia, and they with others in Alabama, and they with others in Louisiana, and they with others in Texas. But the rattlesnakes in Texas will not breed with the rattlesnakes in Florida. See? These are called ring species. Another example is frogs. The frogs in Massachusetts. The frogs in Massachusetts will breed with the ones in Delaware. The ones in Delaware will breed with the ones in Virginia. The ones in Virginia will breed with the ones in Carolina. And the Carolina ones will breed with the ones in Florida. But the Florida frogs will not breed with the Maine frogs. So you see, by slow steps, separating off like this, you have two species. Well, the question is whether they're species or not. They're still frogs. I'm not quite sure, but what if you took time and did it right, maybe they would breed. But to allow small changes like that is not what evolution has always claimed. Microevolution would be evolution within the kinds, and we need not worry about that. But when you get beyond the major types of life, there's where you don't find the evidence, and there, of course, is where Genesis speaks. Now, to go a little bit further in Denton's work, Denton emphasizes particularly that we're in a new situation in biology, and I guess it is probably beyond the ideas of most of us who don't work in that field, the enormous material that has come to light in the last, say, 20, 25 years. The electron microscope has just opened up so many things. And the theory of cell formation has been established so thoroughly now that it's a whole new ball game, really. And that makes a difference with the picture of evolution, and particularly with the origin of life. To take a few moments on that, you all heard that the secret of life has been, so-called, has been discovered. It isn't a secret of life, but it is a secret of life continuing. Inside the cell, there are these chromosomes, and inside those chromosomes is a molecule that is called the DNA molecule. Now, the DNA molecule, we don't need to give it in detail, which is very fortunate, because I couldn't anyway. The DNA molecule apparently is the pattern in the cell for the formation of the proteins that do the actual work. Now, the proteins are very wonderful things. A protein is a long string of material of the amino acids that are hooked together. The amino acids, we're going to be chemists now for a little while. The amino acids, if you want to know the names of the amino acids, you look on the appropriate cereal boxes, and they will tell you. There are 20 amino acids that you need, that all living creatures need. And these amino acids are rather simple in formation. They are a carbon atom, and that is hooked on to a nitrogen atom, and that is hooked on to another carbon atom, which has oxygen and hydrogen on it. Now, this is the formation of an acid for organic chemists, and this is what you have, hydrogen here and hydrogen here. This NH3 is what we call ammonia. So you have ammonia on one side and organic acid on the other side. Hydrogen here and hydrogen here. Carbon hooks on to four items, and oxygen hooks on to two, and hydrogen hooks on to one. So this would be an amino acid. See, it's got ammonia on one side and acid on the other side. Well, that's interesting. But the significant thing, the important thing, is that acids and bases will hook up. The acid-base reaction is fundamental to lots of things. And so if you get two of these, I ought to have another, just understand another backboard, just like this. And on the other side here, you have another nitrogen and on there. And that nitrogen had a hydrogen, and it had a hydrogen. But H2O makes water. And if you take out a water molecule, you have the nitrogen hooking up like this instead. And so what you have is the acid end of one of these amino acids hooking up with the base end of another one, and in turn that hooks up with another one and another one and another one, which we call polymerization. You get the polymer. You get you get a long chain of these amino acids. Now the trick is that there are 20 of these amino acids, but they differ only in what's hooked up here, or what's hooked up here. You might hook up here, you might hook up another carbon, hydrogen, hydrogen, and then you have different amino acids. You could have two of them here. You could have a string. You could have various things hooked up under those two positions, some here and some there. And then you would have a different amino acid. And so there are 20 amino acids that are usable in the body. There are other amino acids, but the ones that are usable in the body are these 20. And these 20 amino acids are the ones that, when they're hooked up like this, it forms a protein. Now you have all kinds of protein in your body formed of these amino acids. And of the 20 amino acids, you don't have this amino acid, number one, plus number one, plus number one, plus number one, plus number one. You don't have it like that. What you have is a mixture. This amino acid might hook up with another one, number two, and that might hook up with another one, number six, and this might hook up with another one, number 13, and so on. Now, the amino acid here may be 100 units long, and how do you make an amino acid like that? You want to be sure that you have the right amino acid. Because if you don't have the right amino acid in every one of these 100 spots, you're sick. If you have one or two of them gone, it's about the end. Now the cell makes these amino acids. And the cell makes these amino acids according to the pattern that is given to it by the DNA. And so you can analyze a creature by the DNA and by his amino acids in the protein chain. Well, that seems very simple. The curious thing is that what seems so simple becomes enormously complicated in its results. That's kind of like, now Dr. Dunbar was saying that material he was reading was likening this material to computers, and that certainly is true. A computer, you know, works with a 1 plus 2 picture. You have a 1 and a 0 plus a 1 and a plus a 1 plus a 0 and so on, and you get a great big number before you know it. And so it is. Those are very simple beginnings. You get a very complicated number, and you can work up into the millions with no trouble. And so it is with these amino acids caused by the DNA. If you want to get a particular protein, and you know what you want, to get it by accident. Now here's the point. So much of this is said to be by accident. If you want to get it by accident, your first one is number one. And that's all right. That's what your protein begins with. Well, you have a chance of 1 in 20 of getting that. Now, the next one is supposed to be number 6. Well, what's the chance of getting number 6 and number 1 together? Well, this is a chance is 1 over 20. And this is a chance of 1 over 20 out of that, which is times that. The chance of getting the two together is 1 over 400. Well, now, the next one is supposed to be 13. What's the chance of getting that by accident? Well, the chance of getting that by accident would be another 20. 20 times 400 would be 80,000. And by the time you go out to 4 or 5, you get a big number. Indeed, if you have 100 places on a small protein, in order to get the right numbers of all of them in the right places by chance, the figure would be 1 over 20 to the 100th power. 1 over 20 to the chances would be that. That's a number so big we can hardly see it. Actually, 20, the number of atoms in all space is 10 to the 70th. And here we get 20 to the 100th power. And people are beginning to say that it is just fantastically impossible to think that chance can do anything like this. In the cell, it is not done by chance. In the cell, the pattern of the DNA, which is also a rather simple compound, composed of one stage after another, not quite as simple as the amino acids, but one unit after another, letter-like form, besides, the DNA is the pattern that gives a structure in the cell the instructions to make one protein after another. Well, now then, the question comes up, here then is replication, but the marvelous thing is that this repeats itself in the next generation, the next generation, the next generation, and repeats itself so wonderfully. And of course, if you would break that at any particular place of any consequence, that's what you call a mutation, and it is fatal. There is a repair mechanism in the cell. It's just a fantastically complicated thing, although it is made up of very basic and not too difficult to make units. But because it repeats itself through these long chains, it becomes something that is really very fantastic. And Michael Denton makes the point, which others have made also and made very effectively, that to imagine that a cell, which is really a factory that manufactures not one amino acid, not one protein, but maybe 1,500 proteins in one cell, it's a whole factory. And it goes right along and it makes them rapidly. In a laboratory, why it would take years to do something like this? In fact, no simple protein so far has been made. Denton says, in the present information, we perhaps can't make one until maybe the end of this century. It might be possible to put one together. They have been analyzed. They have been changed in different ways. But to make a protein, they have not even done. But your cells are doing it all the time, doing it rapidly and doing it perfectly. And if they're not doing it perfectly, you're sick. Now, Denton says, well, I guess maybe two things that I should say, and then it's really I'm talking too long now. Two things. The argument in favor of evolution that has carried a great deal of weight in times past is discussed by Denton adequately, I believe, not particularly on the basis of this chemistry, but it is the argument of similarity. That's an argument that attracts. People can catch it quickly. You can catch it very easily. You've heard it before. The similarity of the hand of a person to the wing of a chicken, to the wing of a bat, to the flipper of a whale, and so on. The similarity is so obvious that they must be related. This is the argument. Well, Denton remarks that there are some things that seem similar that are not related. And one very obvious thing he mentions, so obvious it's laughable, is that this is also true that the five fingers, the formation of the arm, with the one bone here and the two bones here, several bones in the wrist, and then the five digits. This arm is supposedly related to the bat and all that, but it is not, does not, is not derived from your feet. Your feet also, you have one bone in the upper leg and you've got two bones below the knee, then you've got the ankle bones, then you've got the five digits. And this is true all over the mammalian class. And yet the one set of bones comes out from the shoulder bone, and the other set of bone comes out from the pelvic area. And one is not ancestor to the other at all. It's the same plan. It's the same gene, the same chemical structure in the background. But one does not give birth to the other. Well, this is an example of that's rather obvious. There's another example that he mentions that I've used before too, and that is the eye. Darwin said to have written to a friend, Asa Gray, he says, "When I think of the human eye, sometimes it gives me a cold shudder." And Darwin realized that the eye is a very intricate thing, and to think that it happened by accident would stump even Darwin. Darwin recognized there were faults in his theory. He recognized that the fossil record did not support it. He recognized it was difficult to believe that the eye happened by accident. And yet he felt that he had to believe it. Now, the eye of the human is indeed very intricate, and Denton points out that Darwin didn't know very much optics. We see now more than ever of the wonders and intricacies of the eye. But the thing that is rather interesting is that there is an eye for the humans and mammals, but there is a similar eye for the cuttlefish. Now, the cuttlefish, cephalopods, things like a squid, you know, and octopuses and so on, they've got eyes in their head all right, but the eyes of the octopus are not derived from the eyes of the human, nor the eyes of the human derived from the octopus. According to the evolutionary theory, you would have the human eye up here and the octopus eye over here someplace, and they would come down from a formation that had no eye at all. And though it was difficult for Darwin to believe and difficult for us to believe that the eye happened by accident, it is impossible to believe that the eye happened twice by accident. The same way, and the eye of the cephalopod is really very similar to the human eye. There are some significant differences. Of course, they live in a different place, too. They live down in the water where they need a different kind of an eye. This idea here, this is called convergence. That is to say, you have they have the same things coming and working without being derived from a similar ancestor. And that would be true of the hands and the feet, and it is true of the eye, and Denton gives numbers of other examples of convergence like this. And so the argument of homology that has been so remarkable is being overturned. And Denton goes on in details that I can hardly follow, but I recommend, goes on to show that this is particularly true when you look at embryonic development. You look at embryonic development, you have the same things occurring in different mammals, but they occur from different places in the embryo. And they're not derived one from the other. And in the different major forms of life, that this is certainly true. Now, he has the view that is being the view that is being pushed by Denton and by others now goes beyond the work of Gould and Eldredge and others in the saltation theory. And that is to proceed on the basis of your investigation as if there were no evolution. Now, the view here is the view that is called cladism. Cladism, I looked it up in the dictionary, and I couldn't find it. there is one thing that's related. It comes from the Greek word that means branches. But let me give you some examples. I think perhaps would be the best to explain it. Cladism means dividing up the creatures that we have. Now, wait a minute here. Let me get the... I think picture will show best what he intends. If you want to get the relationships between the example he gives first here is man and kangaroo. Well, there's some similarities. But the claim is that man and kangaroo share some similarities. And the most obvious one, of course, is hair. All mammals have hair. Seems rather simple, but the hair is a very unusual thing. And it's very different from feathers, and it's very different from scales, but all mammals have feathers, and they have hair. And that the claim is that you will classify these as one major type because they share certain qualities, not because that they are derived from something. This doesn't say anything about their origin. This simply describes them. You see the difference? And then suppose you want to also discuss hawk. Put over here, hawk. Hawk and the lizard. And now the hawk and the lizard ought to be on the same line here. But the hawk and the lizard, they are related. And they are also related here. They have an amniotic egg. Is that clear? The amniotic egg is different from the eggs of the fish and so on that are laid in the water. And the amniotic egg that has a shell and so on, and is self-sufficient, shall we say, that is a thing that's very, very different and characteristic. And all these creatures, we are like the hawk, we have this. Like the lizard, we have this. Like the kangaroo, we have this only. And then he goes on to other things too, the frog and the salamander, we don't need to. But the point is that he is classifying things by their characteristics and not by their origin. Now that was the view that was probably, that was the usual view in the days before Darwin. We've had 150 years almost of Darwinian classification according to supposed ancestry. But the cladist idea is to jump all that and not face the question of evolution at all, and to classify people, creatures according to type and let it go at that. And this is the view that is being taken by the people of the British Museum of Natural History. Colin Patterson is the one that has been pushing this cladism. And so evolution has turned around now into really a pre-Darwinian type of study in biology. Now, that only scratches the surface, but it does kind of show us, perhaps, what's going on. And if you classify creatures this way, this is fine. So I say this was what was done before Darwin. And this is an overturning, really, of the work of the whole evolutionary movement. Now, of course, what he argues for, then, is this continuity between the different major types of life. And then he says that the biggest discontinuity of all is between living things and non-living things. And when you realize something of the really infinite complexity of living things and realize that all living things depend on this DNA protein synthesis business, and see the possibilities that the possibility that arose by chance. He gives figures here that are just fantastic, fantastically impossible. And the net result is that you have overthrown the evolutionary view as it has been held. The macro, the evolution between major types is going out the window. And praise the Lord. Now he doesn't say that the alternative to it is creation. He does say at the end that don't be too hopeful, because he says facts have never overthrown theory. He quotes Mark Twain. I'm saying that they quote Mark Twain, who says the first thing to do is to be sure you get the facts, and then you can twist them the way you please. And he points out that it was a total revolution of idea when Copernicus saw that the planets moved around the sun instead of around the earth. The data were all known for a long time, but finally they overcame the background of habit and thought. And it was a revolution, a real revolution of thought. And likewise, the phlogiston theory of oxidation. Priestley, who lived in Philadelphia, as they say, discovered oxygen. Before that, they said that phlogiston was a material that escaped when things burned. The whole phlogiston theory held the minds of people, scientists, for quite a while until they found something better. And so he says that the theory, the whole theory has got to be given up. And he kind of pleads for people to be open-minded in that regard. Well, this is only, as I say, scratching the surface, but it is important for us, I think, to realize two things, that the evolutionists are changing their tune, and I hope that we can really capitalize on it much more than we've been able to do. And secondly, this caution that I do feel that some dear friends and good and very capable people have been pushing the Bible a little bit too far and have been putting us in a box on this question of the age of the earth. And that, of course, is something that is a whole other set of problems. And Dr. Newman has gone into that so well and can give you a lot of material on that. But at least the possibilities of an ancient earth, I think, ought to be kept. Well, here's where I would think I should close. If the people are patient enough to ask a few questions, well, I would be happy to take a few if I haven't made something clear. Yes. That's a good question. Scientific American and places like that do, Nature magazine and so on, these that are more technical, do indeed give the views of Gould. The views of Denton and Cladism are even a little bit more recent, and it'll be a while before they are as widely mentioned, I think, as the National Geographic is popular, and you can't take very good pictures of amino acids, and that has something to do with it. Yes. Anything else? No. Well, the hour is late already, and it's time for us to close.